The FM band is from 88 megahertz up to 108.
You've got this frequency. We're going to call you CKUT. You've got this frequency, 98.3. That frequency is what you're picking up when you tune that radio.
Very impressive.
You can sit on the moon and it looks like they pick up CKUT, clear as a bell.
Fascinating. Your analysis seems logical.
CKUT is on the air.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
Welcome to Off the Hour here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are just one day into the new year, and on this, the first edition of Long Term Memory Radio for 2003, we'll take a look back at the life of Madeleine Perron. Not long ago, this lifelong union activist and feminist born and raised in Quebec stopped by our studios to reflect on her life work organizing in textile factories since the 1940s. At the age of 84, she has a long list of accomplishments and current activities. Today, she works with the Fédération du Film du Québec, where she is an active member and sits on the Regional Council for the Montreal area, the National Action Committee on the Status of Women in 1972. She helped the creation of the committee after a conference on the Royal Commission on the Status of Women's report. She's one of the founding members of the National Action Committee on the Status of Women. She's also a member of CUSO and alternatives organizations which help establish contacts with people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. She's also a lifetime member of the South Asian Women's Community Center, plus on the committee for raising funds for French-speaking women's shelter, and she also works in collaboration with the Quebec Native Women's Association. This after working from 1942 to 1952 with the AFL, she also helped establish the Canadian Textile Council, later called the Canadian Textile Chemical Union, from 1952 to 1983 when she retired. At the age of 65, Madeleine Perron spent her last years of union organizing involved in the creation of the Confederation of Canadian Unions, in which she was the vice president for Eastern Canada in 1983. Do stay tuned on this edition of Long-Term Memory Radio. We will hear from Madeleine Perron, a lifetime feminist and union activist. For more information on anything you hear tonight or for cassette copies, please contact CKUT's Community News Collective at 514-398-6787, extension 2593, or send us an email at news@ckut.ca. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. Do stay tuned.
He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I have read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His truth is marching on.
Glory, glory, hallelujah.
I have read fiery gospel, written burnished rows of steel. As ye deal with my condemners, so with you my grace shall deal. Let the hero born of woman crush the serpent with his heel. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Joining us today is Madeleine Perron, and we're very pleased to have her because she has a lifelong history with union activism in Quebec, and she's joined us today to talk about that. Maybe, Madeleine, you could start by giving us an introduction to yourself and your work.
I am a French-speaking person who went to convent. And then to McGill University. I got involved at McGill in a campaign to win government scholarships for students whose families could not afford to send them to college. We lost that campaign in the immediate, but it's interesting that after the war, veterans were granted university costs if they wanted to go back, and that sort of broke the kind of favored atmosphere for people who could afford university education. I think we had a part in that. The campaign for scholarships for poor students was a great experience for me. And I decided that I was going to work with in organizing workers, especially women. In 1942, I was secretary of the AFL Union's campaign to organizing war industry. I was there only a few months when there was a reorganization of the work, and I was secretary of the regular organizing committee of the Trades and Labor Council of Montreal. In war industry, we must have had about 30,000 workers just producing bombs and shells. Canada was the arsenal of Great Britain in that war, and the workforce on hourly pay doubled in 4 years only. In the shell and bomb plants, most of the workers were women. They had to be people of high personal discipline because handling shells was so dangerous, gunpowder all the time. They organized rather quickly, and there was not that much opposition by the companies because they intended to close down after the war anyway. But in many other plants, there was terrible opposition. In 1942, I joined in the campaign to organize cotton mill workers, somewhat to the displeasure of some of the what we would call business unionists, who thought there was no point in organizing women and children because child labor was exploited there in those days. Well, that was enough to get my back up, and I joined the struggle for us to be able to organize in the cotton mills. We were able to work at it and got the proper appointments to do it, and organized amongst the Dominion textile workers, where at least 40% of the 6,000 workers whom we were working with were women, and there was a fair percentage of children as well. The children turned out, contrary to what business unionists thought, to be good unionists because they followed the women. since the women were the ones who defended them against harassment and beatings in the plants. They were the people who helped them to be on guard against machines that were too big and too strong for them, and that they might be tempted to climb up on sometimes and be injured. So they just followed the women, and that was fine. The women are the ones who set the pace of production in the mill, because they were nearly all piece workers, whereas some of the men were mechanics, others apprentice mechanics, others machine cleaners, and so on. And so they ran the fastest, to the detriment of their health. And management was exceedingly strict and absolutely impervious to women's problems and to their health. The fact was that many women lost their health in these plants just because they had to run too fast all the time. And they ran in fear, of course, of losing their jobs if they didn't keep the pace that was expected of them. We started in Valleyfield, which had the biggest cotton mill in Canada, 3,300 workers at the time. After initial contacts by the organizer with a number of people, mostly men, a public meeting was called, and it was the opinion of the organizer and of the president, who was an older man, had seen many struggles before, and never sold out, that it had to be clear to the women that they were welcome to that meeting, because the tradition was that women weren't expected to go to union meetings. So I was announced as one of the speakers. And women came in groups. They had consulted, they came organized. And on the other hand, men would just wander into the meeting hall, either in twos or singles. They felt at home there. But the women were different. They sat together, and they had an obvious leading person that they counted on. At the end of these speeches, people were asked to ask questions or make whatever remarks they had in turn. Men would make remarks or ask questions almost on the spur of the moment, whereas the women had their spokesperson, and she, in consulting, would ask a question which the women were really interested in as a group. She asked about seniority rights and the security for their jobs, which they had, and how much they could oppose, speed up, and injustices once they had a union contract, which we discussed with them. I went over to them after the meeting was over, and we discussed again a little bit more openly, since we were just women. And they signed their union card, paid their initiation fee, and before leaving, their spokesperson said, "Well, now, once we get the union in and a contract, we'll have that security on the job that we need, because we'll be able to oppose the foreman's harassment." There were a number of questions about women who were preferred by bosses because they gave in to their attentions. But I found that subsequently, some of those women who gave in to bosses wanted to be part of the women's group, and they became more independent as they realized there was hope, and because they wanted to belong. and not be separated off with bosses who were not liked anyway. After we had the majority in that plant, I was given the assignment of working to help organize the Montreal plants of the same company, which altogether had about 3,000 workers. We worked at that, and I must say that there had been contacts made by a mechanic. So the first meeting was of those contacts. It wasn't a big meeting. They might have been 20 or 25. Well, there were two shift meetings. So one had about 20 and the other had maybe about the same number, all men. And we had rented an old hall in the working class district of St. Henry. And one of the men came and helped to stoke the fires. And then he sat down and he said, "Well, where's the organizer?" And I said, "I'm the organizer." So he said, "Une petite fille." So I started off with the issues, and they had to think fast to tune up on what the meeting was about, and there was never a repetition of that in that group. At the second meeting, I asked the men where the women were and who would be good contacts amongst the women. And the main spokesperson amongst the mechanics said, "Oh, they're not interested." So I asked again and looked at a number of these other fellows. And one mechanic said, "Well, Mother so-and-so and her two daughters." Oh, no, I asked them what happened in the 1937 strike. They had had a strike and it was broken and there was nothing left after. And we were at the beginning of 1943 by then. So I said, "Well, where were they in the 1937 strike?" Oh, one fellow opened up and said, "They were very good. They went after the women's scabs, and they went and visited them in their homes, and Mother so-and-so and her two daughters were amongst the best." And that was from the weave room. And in the spinning, there was another woman spinner who said, "Are they still there?" "Yes, they're still there." So I got indications of where they lived. A large number of the cotton mill workers lived close to the cotton mill in the Lachine Canal Belt in St. Henry at the time. And so I went to visit Mother so-and-so and met her two daughters as well. And she was very curious to know who recommended her, because it was important for her. I said, "Oh, you know, there's a lot of mechanics there." "Yes, but who?" I said, "I'm sorry, we don't give the names of any of our members. Later on you'll know, but we've promised not to give them away because the company might want to take reprisals against them, as we would do with you." So she and her two daughters signed, but she was very enthused to know that there was a man or some men who trusted her with union activity. The spinner, the older spinner we found, became quite a militant as well, and the women followed her advice, and to the point where years later, we still didn't have a contract. It took 4 years to get first contract and the strike. But we had one of these short strikes, and the women took a picket line. It was not a legal strike, technically. And at one point, the police who had gathered at the end of the block ran forward to charge them. And the women broke into a song, a French song called J'attendrai, which is a love song. J'attendrai le jour et la nuit, ton retour. So when they got up to them, the policeman stopped and they said, what's this? Well, we've been waiting for the company to meet us for 3 years, and they're still not meeting us. Oh. So the police turned around and went back to the end of the block. But men wouldn't think of that kind of a tactic. They had worked it out. I had no idea. And they knew how to deal with it. In order to get an understanding of their cause and to show that there was some merit to it, they were very strong. In the course of those years when we were trying to go towards a contract, we had won certifications. But there was nothing in the laws which forced the company to negotiate in good faith. They were obliged to meet with us, but the meetings were never dealt with in good faith by management. They were just trying to destroy the union. So at some point we had a slowdown amongst the members, and it got to the point where when they'd go into the factory the next day or another second or third day, the guards would ask them, are you going to work? Why, of course I'm going to work. And they'd start working. And after a little while, they'd start to slow down and slow down. And later they were sitting down. And this went on for a few days. But the women were very good at it. And in as much as they were able, a group of them, to stand together, they acquired a sense of their own worth and a feeling that they do have rights, but they have to fight for them. And so, even though we didn't have a contract and didn't have any rights signed by the company and acknowledged by the company, just by standing together, they managed to protect themselves against more harassment by the boss. And that was quite an experience for them. We had strikes in those mills, both in Valleyfield and Montreal, in 1946. It was long, it was tough. And the Valleyfield strike lasted longer than the Montreal one because the company had agreed in Montreal because of technicalities in the law. But we decided that before the Montreal workers would get the report and decide whether they wanted to settle, they would have to ask the Valleyfield workers whether they agreed or not. And that was a great and passionate meeting by the Valleyfield workers. We explained that the position in Valleyfield with one mill with 3,300 workers was better than the position in Montreal with mills spread out across the city, that there were scabs in the Montreal mills and there were none in the Valleyfield mill, but that the Montreal people would not accept the settlement unless the Valleyfield people consented. And that would mean that we'd have a foot in the door of the company, and perhaps we could use that contract if they... Well, the Valleyfield people agreed. I must say that in the Valleyfield case, the church was very, very much opposed to the union. And I always felt that what frightened them most was that the women were so involved in the union. That they couldn't accept. But the hierarchy of the church, together with Premier Maurice Duplessis and the then leader of what was then the Catholic syndicates, it's a much better union now, it's the Confédération des Syndicats Nationaux, and it's not a confessional union, it's completely a lay union. But in 1937, they had betrayed the workers. So there was distrust there. And the Bishop of Valleyfield, technically he was the auxiliary bishop, but he was in fact the leader of the church there, did everything in his power to destroy the union, up to and including organizing a group of misled young people who thought they were the bishop's army and tried to run us out of town. They didn't succeed, and the demonstration lasted over midnight when some of the workers started going about town to look for their sons who hadn't come home and found them demonstrating against us and told them, "You don't do that. I am in the union and I'm your father, and you just come home with me." So it broke up the demonstration. But we were attacked by that bishop constantly. And so some of the wives of the workers would say, "Well, what is this business? After all, they were Roman Catholics and practicing and listened to the teachings of the church. And they heard from the church that I was supposed to have been a Russian dropped by a submarine on the coast of Gaspé." And the husbands would say, "Well, no, we know her. Come on." So I told the men, tell them to come to the union meeting. Find out for themselves, that's all. So when meetings got larger and we were close to the crisis with the company, the women came. But they didn't come with their husbands. They met each other and came and sat as a group of women. These were the wives and mothers of the workers. And, of course, they related to the women workers. And when we had a bitter crisis in a strike in 1946, after about 8 weeks of strike, and the church had launched all of its forces against us, calling would-be strike breakers to go to Mass, promising that the curate or the vicar would lead them towards the plant where the provincial police of Du Plessis would usher them into the plant as strike breakers and so on. This happened for 2 days. And on the third day, they were still a minority, about 200 out of 3,300. But it was dangerous. And on the third day, the mothers and wives of strikers organized. In those days, bread was delivered to the house. Ice was delivered in blocks to the house. The baker delivered the bread. And they had organized and told all these people, now you tell all the women on your line that we are meeting at the plant at 11 o'clock. The strike breakers were to be ushered out at 12 and go back again for 1 o'clock. By the time 11 o'clock came on, there were not only the regular picketers and strikers, but the housewives and their sons of about 12 years up.
I just had to get that out.
That happens to me sometimes, too.
I was trying to suppress the sneeze.
It's better to
not
have it.
Okay, I'm better.
So the mothers, the wives, and their sons of 11 years old or so were there with the strikers, and there was a mass of almost 5,000 people grouped around two of the main mill gates and also two other lesser gates. And the police got excited. Those were not the city police. They were Du Plessis' force of provincial police. In Valleyfield, the city police never attacked us. They kept peace in the town, and they managed coordination and so on, but they were not strike breakers. And the chief of police and the mayor had disarmed the policemen in Valleyfield on the first morning of the strike to make their position very clear. So with about 5,000 people around, quite peaceful but very, very vigilant, the provincial police got excited. They propped up guns, and it wasn't known what it was going to be, but it turned out to be tear gas. So they attacked the protesters with tear gas in order to free the ground for the strike breakers to go out. And people replied with rocks. For some reason, the city had cut up the street in order to repave it, and all of the rocks were there, the cut-up pavement and so on. So there were a number of volleys of tear gas, and every time, never before, but right after, there'd be one volley of rocks thrown until the police were quite exasperated, put up a white handkerchief showing that they wanted to talk. And two of the organizers, including Kent Rowley, were going to go in. And the wives said, no, we will go in with you, two of us, because if you go in, they'll probably arrest you and that'll be the end of it. So the two wives of strikers went in as bodyguards to the two male organizers. And eventually, that strike was settled and a contract was signed. But the role of the women at the most critical moments was crucial. We could have been smashed if it hadn't been for that, considering that the Du Plessis government was against us with full force, used the courts against us, used its provincial police, that the company, of course, was against us, and that the leaders of the Catholic Church in the region were solidly against us. The Archbishop of Montreal at the time, Monseigneur Charbonneau, was sympathetic to the workers, but the authorities saw to it that, except for talking to employers and to other priests who were hostile, that he didn't have very much success. And eventually, the Du Plessis government sent two of its cabinet ministers to the Vatican to ask for removal of Monseigneur Charbonneau because he was too favorable to the workers. And that happened. And the Bishop of Valleyfield, who was hostile, was named in his place and eventually made a cardinal. So you can imagine the extent to which the church of those days, when it had great power in Quebec, went in order to prevent people from organizing freely in organizations where they could have their say and make the decisions, and especially to prevent women from being a vocal and active part of these organizations.
Petite boîte, très étroite, petite boîte, faites un tiki-taki, petite boîte, petite boîte, petite boîte, tout pareil. Il y a des rouges, des violettes. Ces gens-là dans la boîte vont tous à l'université. On les met tous dans des boîtes, petites boîtes, tout pareil. Y a des médecins, des dentistes, des hommes d'affaires et des avocats. Ils sont tous, tous faits de tiki-taki. Ils sont tous, tous pareils.
You're tuned into a special two-hour presentation of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project here on CKT 90.3 FM. What we're doing for you in this 2 hours is listening to a conversation that we had earlier with Madeleine Perron. She came in studios not too long ago. She's a lifelong union activist and feminist born and raised in Quebec. And she stopped in our studios to reflect on her life work organizing in textile factories since the 1940s. And so what you've been hearing about is her life and work in the early 1940s. From 42 to 52, she was working for the AFL, and then she worked to establish a new association of textile workers called the Canadian Textile Council, and she worked with that organization from 1952 to 1983. She is a very, very active woman. We originally wanted to speak with her back when we were doing a series called Women's Labor History in Quebec and Canada. This was last April of 2002, and she's in and involved with so many different organizations. It was hard to get in touch with her. At the age of 85, she's working with the Fédération des Femmes du Québec. She's was a founding member of the National Action Committee. She's involved with many local organizations here in Montreal, including the South Asian Women's Community Center. Plus, she raises funds for a French-speaking women's shelter, and she works in collaboration with the Quebec Native Women's Association. We're going to go now to another track of Madeleine Perron. Again, we're going to do this on through the 7 o'clock hour, And this next track, we'll hear about the issues that women brought to the table and the differences between those issues and demands over the period from 1942 to 1983. Again, you're listening to CKT 90.3 FM.
Speak more about your experience as a union organizer from the 1940s and 60s. What were the issues that women were bringing to you, specifically their concerns as women?
Yes. Of course, I was a new union organizer until 1983, if we are talking about women. And there are experiences in that latter period as well, which are quite interesting. But their desire for a collective agreement was not primarily for wages. Of course they wanted the wages, but the men wanted the wages even more. They wanted increases. But the women wanted seniority rights so that they could make complaints when there were injustices, when there was harassment, when their machines were speeded up and as peace workers they were becoming exhausted keeping up with the machines and constantly under pressure from the foreman to perform. They wanted some release from that kind of pressure, which was very injurious to their health anyway. They also wanted that in the union they have a voice, because in many unions they didn't have a voice. They were just expected to go along. And with no encouragement, in many unions men came and the women didn't bother to go because they felt there wasn't any use in going. They wouldn't get anywhere. Whereas they wanted to go but be heard. Though they did have problems, because women not only were working in a factory, and it was, in the beginning, it was 10 hours a day, in wartime, 5.5 days a week, working on the Saturday from 7 a.m. to 12. Or if they were night shift workers in wartime, then from 12 to 5 p.m. But they also had to look after their families. So if you called all meetings on an evening far away from work, they didn't have the time. And once they went home and prepared supper for the family or whatever it was, they'd want to change their clothes and look clean and better going outside. And all this was too much of an imposition for a woman who worked 50 or 55 hours a week and who had chores at home, which she would not give up, of course. So it was important, and we did manage to have some meetings immediately after work, so that workers would come directly to a meeting hall as close to the factory as possible. We would time it to try to have the meeting not last more than 1 hour. They'd all come in working clothes, of course. So there was no great effort. And also they would encourage each other to come to the meeting hall. I remember and this is in Toronto, in the 1970s, one factory where we had nearly all immigrant women. Some were women from Greece, some were from China, some were from Italy, And there were some from the Isles in the Atlantic. And the strongest women were the Greek women, because the work was very heavy. They made tents, amongst other things. And when you have to join the floors of a large tent alone, you need strength. If you want to join the then joined floors to the walls, you need, and to the roof and so on. And they were valued by the company, though the company would never admit it, but they knew their worth. And we would stand at the gates for a meeting after work, always to go just 5 minutes down the street to a meeting hall in that community. And the Chinese women who did more delicate work, they didn't have the strength, the physical strength. If some would say, oh, I've got to go home, my husband and my children. And a Greek woman would say, I've got a husband and children too, but he's going to wait. We go for 1 hour and we go together. And what happened was we, on the bargaining committee of that union, we had one Chinese woman who didn't understand very much, but she represented the Chinese women. And in between sessions, we would explain to her what was being discussed and what was going to be discussed. And I remember asking her once towards the end of the bargaining, since we were, thanks, close to a decision to strike or to settle, depending on what would be the last offer. And I said, what will the Chinese women do? She said, well, the Chinese women and I would accept the offer that the company has already made. But if the Greek women strike, we'll strike with them, because we could not live in that plant without them, because they help us out all the time. And in fact, we didn't strike that time, but later when the company threatened to shut down the plant and take it elsewhere where there were less unions, wherever the Greek women were in the occupation of the plant, there were Chinese women with them. And so there was that kind of solidarity. They knew whom to trust. And when they were in trouble, they knew who would come to their rescue. And that was sufficient for them to understand. We had a situation where when you came to contract meetings, though, every 2 years, where you reported on the last negotiations and the choice was to accept the settlement offered or to strike, then we would have to rent a bigger hall. And a number of these immigrant women who couldn't speak English couldn't get around town that easily. They knew the road to the factory, but they weren't good at getting around town. So we allowed them to invite their husbands to come, and these were usually large church halls. So the women, the members, and a few men who worked there, but they were not numerous, would sit in the center of the hall, and the husbands or older sons would sit in single chairs around the hall, and that was it. So they didn't interfere in the discussion. And at one point, when we had had a strike 2 years before in a knitting plant in Toronto, 2 years after, and it was a successful strike, 2 years after we came to a contract meeting like that where they had to accept the settlement or decide to strike. And we tried to make it a point that the president elected in the union, we encouraged it, was one of the largest immigrant group of women. And they would always end up asking her, Maria, what are you going to vote? How are you going to vote? And anyway, in the instance of the strike, she had said, you do what you want, but I'll vote for strike. And by secret ballot vote, they all voted for strike. They knew where they were going because they had confidence in her. But 2 years later, the recommendation was to settle. So two of the men were sitting there together and being polite with each other. They knew each other from the church and the community. And one man said to the other after the decision, they should have struck. That wasn't good enough. And the other man said, and where was your wife when mine was on the picket line for 3 months? You kept her at home to do your work. That's not the way we win a strike. Next time, make sure that if my wife is on the picket line, your wife goes through too. But it was interesting that there had never been an argument between them. They weren't that close friends. But here you had the man who supported his wife, whatever she did, and the one who just used her, but tried to be very fresh and pretend to be militant. And we had suggested to women immigrants when we approached a situation where we may have to strike, to discuss with their husbands and deal with them. And if their husbands had been in a strike somewhere, to remind them how they supported their husbands and didn't complain and say, well, now if it's my turn, I expect the same from you. And as it turned out, the women who did talk about it and negotiate with their husbands had their support. And the others who were too fearful to assert themselves at home were told, now you stay here and work because you're not going to be paid for what you'll be doing. But then, of course, our problem after a strike is always to warn the strikers not to take revenge on those who were non-strikers, but to try to help them to understand that we only progressed because of the fight we put up together. So these are things which happen. Now, one of the very important issues for women, and we go back to the 1940s, of course, was pregnancy leave. Just pregnancy leave as a first step with retention of seniority and the right to go back to their jobs. And that took a long time to win. But we had a few instances where, even in the 1940s, with no pregnancy leave clause, the women were united enough that before a pregnant woman left the plant to go and have the baby, they'd have a little party after work in the plant, calling the foreman and say, now Julie or whoever is going on pregnancy, she's a good worker, and we want you to tell her now that you'll take her back when she's ready. So there was nothing written, but if the foreman didn't agree, then they were all against him, and he had to be careful about that. Otherwise, and when he agreed, then they'd have a glass, whether it was water or juice, or it didn't matter. They sort of said, well, that's good. But that was very important. And just about all of the early contracts didn't have it. So we had to en chemin, so to speak, while we were fighting for it, at the same time try to impose it on management in practice.
You go marching to the table. You see the same old thing with its heart. She goes a-walking to the curb.